Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Our musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this very day, back in 1975, that Steve Anderson set a record for picking a guitar. Anderson, at age 22, picked for how long? Hint, he broke the old record by more than 4 hours. So, what was the new record for guitar picking? Was it A, 4 hours? Was it C, 14 hours? Was it C, 54 hours, or was it D, 114 hours? And question number two, it was on this day, back in 1935, that the Hoboken Four appeared on the Major Bowes Amateur Hour on WOR Radio. Who was their lead singer? Hint, this singer's later nickname was Chairman of the Board. So who was he? Was it A, Donald Trump? B, Mao Zedong? Was it C, Sam Cooke, or was it D, Frank Sinatra? 1935, lead singer for the Hoboken Four. The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of September the 7th. Well, it was on this day, back in 1936, that Charles Harden, H-O-L-L-E-Y, later Buddy Holly, without the E, was born in Lubbock, Texas. His name was misspelled on his first record contract, and he decided to leave it that way. And it was 62 years ago today, 1956, that Elvis Presley made his first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show, Toast of the Town. He was shot from just the waist up during the performance. Elvis would make a total of 3 appearances on that show. Martin and Edie Brickell's When You Get to Asheville introduce our country and bluegrass music news. It's an article published in pinecone.org, August 2018, entitled Shout and Shine, a Celebration of Diversity in Bluegrass. That's coming up on Monday, September 24, 2018. Lobby doors, 6 p.m. Auditorium opens at 6:45 p.m. Show at 7 p.m. General admission seating. This is at Daniels Auditorium, North Carolina Museum of History, 5 East Edenton Street in Raleigh. Tickets are $20 for Pinecone members and $25 for the general public. Pinecone is proud to team up with the Bluegrass Situation again for the 3rd annual Shout and Sign, a celebration of diversity in bluegrass. This year's effort will honor the connection and cross-pollination between blues, bluegrass, and their offshoots at the very beginning of IBMA's World of Bluegrass events in Raleigh.
She won't sleep in the house now. She just listens for the sound.
For the first time, the showcase is a ticketed sit-down concert that will benefit the IBMA Trust Fund and the Music Maker Relief Foundation. Presented by BGS and Pinecone, Shout and Shine is the first event of its kind at the week-long Bluegrass Business Conference and Festival. Born in 2016 as a direct response to the NC General Assembly's controversial bathroom bill, HB 2, Shout and Shine's third year has grown and refocused its mission on highlighting and reincorporating these voices, not only at the showcase, but throughout the week-long convention and festival. This year's theme will be built upon the connection between North Carolina's Piedmont Blues Pickers and Bluegrass, pairing musicians from the Music Maker Relief Foundation with the best and brightest of bluegrass to illustrate that vernacular music from Appalachia and its offshoot genres would not exist in their current forms without people of color, African Americans, African slaves, and the influence of the music they created. Doors to the museum open at 6 p.m. Auditorium open 6:45 p.m. and the showcase begins at 7. Headlining this year is Che Appalachia, a four-man string band from Argentina founded by fiddler and songwriter Joe Troop, who is originally from Winston-Salem. The band was featured earlier this month on All Things Considered.
Sunshine, when she gone.
And in jazz and blues music news, we have this article. It's published in answers.yahoo.com, and it's entitled Difference Between Memphis Blues and Chicago Blues. Question. I am getting into blues now, and I really love Bo Diddley, Elmore James, Howlin' Wolf, and B.B. King. I've heard there are a lot of different kinds of blues. What's the difference between Chicago and Memphis, or any other kinds? The best answer. The Chicago blues is a form of blues music that developed in Chicago, Illinois, by adding electrically amplified guitar, drums, piano, bass guitar, and sometimes saxophone to the basic guitar, harmonica, delta blues. The music developed mainly as a result of the great migration of poor black workers from the South into the industrial cities of the North, such as Chicago in particular, in the first half of the 20th century. Chicago blues has a more extended palette of notes than the standard six-note blues scale. Often, notes from the major scale are added, which give the music a more jazz feel, while still being in the confines of the blues genre. This is not, however, as prominent as Texas blues, which contains many other notes such as the major third and major sixth. Chicago blues is also known for its heavy rolling bass. Another notable point is that Chicago blues contains many dominant ninth chords, and the scales usually contain ninth notes. Note that a second is the same as a ninth. The notoriously confusing 9 = 2 seen on many chord charts reflects that fact. And this is especially emphasized on guitar, on which it is more difficult to span octaves than on a piano.
Ain't no sunshine when you're gone. This house just ain't home. Anytime she goes away.
The Memphis Blues is a style of blues music that was created in the 1920s and 1930s by Memphis area musicians like Frank Stokes, Sleepy John Estes, Furry Lewis, and Memphis Minnie. The style was popular in vaudeville and medicine shows and was associated with Memphis's main entertainment area, Beale Street. Some musicologists believe that it was in the Memphis blues that the separate roles of rhythm and lead guitar were defined. This two-guitar concept has become standard in rock and roll in much of popular music. In addition to guitar-based blues, jug bands such as Gus Cannon's Jug Stompers and the Memphis Jug Band were extremely popular practitioners of Memphis blues. The jug band style emphasized the danceable, syncopated rhythms of early jazz and a range of other archaic folk styles. It was played on simple, sometimes homemade instruments such as harmonicas, violins, mandolins, banjos, and guitars, backed by washboards, kazoo, jew's harp, and jugs thrown in to supply the bass. After World War II, electric instruments became popular among Memphis blues musicians as African Americans left the Mississippi Delta and other impoverished areas of the South for urban areas. Many musicians gravitated to Memphis's blues scene, changing the classic Memphis blues sound. Musicians such as Howlin' Wolf, Willie Nix, Ike Turner, and B.B. King performed on Beale Street and in West Memphis and recorded some of the classic electric blues, rhythm and blues, and country and rock and roll records for labels such as Sun Records. These musicians had a strong influence on later musicians in these styles, notably the early rock and rollers and rockabillies, many of whom also recorded for Sun Records. And in classical music news, we have this article titled, Five Composers with Synesthesia. This is published in ClassicalMusic.com on the 14th of August, 2018, by Michael Beek. With Scriabin's The Poem of Ecstasy rounding off tonight's prom, we list four other composers who claim to see music as color. Alexander Scriabin. The composer was very much influenced by his color sense, going on to write Prometheus, the poem of fire, which featured the clavier à lumières, or luce, a keyboard instrument which emitted light instead of sound. Jean Sibelius, the Finnish composer, was apparently very much a multi-synesthesiate, in that he claimed to also hear sounds in his mind when he saw colors, objects, or via sense. Perhaps he truly heard the sound of silence. And then there's Olivier Messiaen, a colorful composer in every sense. Messiaen once tried to describe his sensory skills, stating, I see colors when I hear sounds, but I don't see colors with my eyes. I see colors intellectually in my head. And then there's Georgi Ligeti. The Hungarian composer was quite open about his synesthesia, stating major chords are red or pink, minor chords are somewhere between green and brown. He claimed to also have had the ability to see numbers as colors. And then Franz Liszt. It is said the composer would speak to musicians in terms of the colors they needed to achieve in their performances, and is quoted as giving directions such as, a little bluer, if you please. This tone type requires it. Which brings us to music research and technology. So we ask the question, what is synesthesia anyway? And it's an article entitled Everyday Fantasia, the World of Synesthesia. With the help of sophisticated behavioral brain imaging and molecular genetic methods, researchers are coming closer to understanding what drives the extraordinary sensory condition called synesthesia. This is published American Psychological Association, that is, APA.org, and it's written by Siri Carpenter and published on March 2001, Volume 32, Number 3. Guitar music doesn't just tickle Carol Crane's fancy, it also brushes softly against her ankles. When she hears violins, She also feels them on her face. Trumpets make themselves known on the back of her neck. In addition to feeling the sounds of musical instruments on her body, Crane sees letters and numbers in brilliant hues, and, for her, units of time each have their own shape. She sees the months of the year as the cars on a Ferris wheel, with July at the top, December at the bottom. Sean Day, Ph.D., tastes in Technicolor. The taste of beef, such as steak, produces a rich blue, says Day, a linguistics professor at National Central University in Taiwan. Mango sherbet appears as a wall of lime green with thin, wavy strips of cherry red. Steamed, gingered squid produces a large glob of bright orange foam about 4 feet away, directly in front of me. Crane and Day share an extraordinary sensory condition called synesthesia. This phenomena, whose name derives from the Greek meaning to perceive together, comes in many varieties. Some synesthesiates hear, smell, taste, or feel pain in color. Others taste shape, and still others perceive written digits, letters, and words in color. Some who possess what researchers call conceptual synesthesia see abstract concepts such as units of time or mathematical operations as shapes projected either internally or in the space around them. And many synesthetes experience more than one form of the condition. The condition is not well known, in part because many synesthetes fear ridicule for their unusual ability. Often people with synesthesia describe having been driven to silence after being derided in childhood for describing sensory connections that they had not realized were atypical. For scientists, synesthesia presents an intriguing problem. Studies have confirmed that the phenomena is biological, automatic, and apparently unlearned, distinct from both hallucination and metaphor. The condition runs in families and is more common among women than men, researchers now know. But until recently, researchers could only speculate about the causes of synesthesia. Now, however, modern behavioral brain imaging and molecular genetic tools hold exciting promise for uncovering the mechanisms that drive synesthesia, and researchers hope for better understanding how the brain normally organizes perception and cognition. Research suggests that about 1 in 2,000 people are synesthetes, and some experts suspect that as many as 1 in 300 people have some variation of the condition. The writer Vladimir Nabokov was reputedly a synesthete, as were the composer Olivier Messiaen and the physicist Richard Feynman. The most common form of synesthesia, researchers believe, is colored hearing, sounds, music, or voices seen as colors. Most synesthetes report that they see such sounds internally, in the mind's eye. Only a minority, like Day, see visions as if projected outside the body, usually within arm's reach. Some synesthetes report experiencing sensory overload, becoming exhausted from so much stimulation. But usually condition is not a problem. Indeed, most synesthetes treasure what they consider a bonus sense. If you ask synesthetes if they'd wish to be rid of it, they almost always say no, said Simon Baron Cohen, Ph.D., who studies synesthesia at the University of Cambridge. For them, it feels like that's what normal experience is like. To have that taken away would make them feel like they were being deprived of one sense. The article skips down and ends with this: implications for psychologists. Interest in synesthesia extends far beyond just the study of the few individuals who experience the phenomena. We tend to think of our experiences, and especially the visual system, as being bottom-up, he remarks, but there are many instances where meaning goes back down and influences our lower-order perception of the world. Synesthesia is just one very rare and exceptional example of that. The possibility that synesthesia has genetic roots is equally tantalizing, especially if it turns out that a single gene controls the condition, as some have speculated. At a practical level, many researchers observed, research on synesthesia will help raise the condition's visibility, reducing the risk that clinicians might mistake it as a sign of mental illness.
But committed no crime and bad mistakes. I've made a few. I've had my share of bad kicks in my face.
And in rock and pop music news, we have this article entitled Top Sports Songs. They make you jump, cheer, and even cry. This is written by Ray Frager, published in FoxSports.com, 20th of October, 2016. Coming in at number 10 is the Blitzkrieg Bop. The Ramones, Hey Ho, Let's Go, That's All You Need, an exhortation that fits any crowd, any team, any sport. Number 9, YMCA, The Village People, from toddlers to grandmas, everyone gets up at the ballpark and joins in to spell it out. This is perhaps the most long-lasting legacy of the disco era. Number 8, Bugler's Dream, Leo Arnaud. You know it's the Olympics theme, instantly rings in the ears. Number 7, Chariots of Fire, Vangelis. Let's all go run in slow motion on the beach on our way to Olympic glory. Number 6, Sports Center theme. Da, da, da. So ubiquitous that college bands took it up. Number 5, Center Field, John Fogerty. Loved the hand claps, and the allusion to Chuck Berry's brown-eyed handsome man makes up for name-checking noted racist Ty Cobb. Number 4, We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions. And this is by Queen. Yeah, we're gonna rock you, and then we'll be the champions. Isn't that how it works? And that's what's playing in the background right now. And then there's Rock and Roll Part 2. That's Gary Glitter. It's the Hey Song with the ringing guitar. You don't need any real lyrics. Then number 2, One Shining Moment by Luther Vandross. Yes, there are other versions, but we happen to prefer Vandross's. Number 1, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. You don't even have to be a baseball fan to know this one. It's embedded in American culture. It's as much a part of going to the ballpark as a hot dog and a beer. It's Harry Carey and a parade of celebrity guest singers at Wrigley Field. And it doesn't even matter whether you still buy Cracker Jacks at the stadium. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this very day back in 1975 that Steve Anderson set a record for picking a guitar. At age 22, Anderson picked for how long? Hint, he broke the old record by more than 4 hours, so what was the new record for guitar picking? Was it A, a few minutes above 4 hours? Was it B, a few minutes above 14 hours? Was it C, a few minutes above 54 hours? Or D, a few minutes above 114 hours? And the correct answer is answer D. Steve Anderson set a record for picking a guitar at age 22. He picked for 114 hours and 7 minutes, breaking the old record by more than 4 hours. And the answer to our second question? It was on this day back in 1935 that the Hoboken Four appeared on the Major Bowes Amateur Hour on WOR Radio. Who was their lead singer? Hint, this singer's later nickname was Chairman of the Board. So, who was he? Was it A, Donald Trump, B, Mao Zedong, C, Sam Cooke, or D, Frank Sinatra? 1935, lead singer Hoboken 4, and the correct answer D. Frank Sinatra. As noted in OTRCat.com, the amateur talent contest craze was at its height in the 1930s, and Major Bowes stepped in to take advantage of it. At the height of the Depression, this popular show made the Major a rich man, making $2 million a year, twice that of Al Jolson and Jack Benny. Poor folks traveled from all over the country to be on the New York show, selling their houses, hitching rides, traveling in boxcars. Over 10,000 people applied weekly to be on the program. Many of the applicants were poor black men from the South, hoping to tap dance, sing, or harmonica their way to fame and fortune. Most were turned away, as only 500 to 700 were auditioned, and only 20 appeared on the show. Even after making the cutthroat competition and appearing live on the show, many were gonged off before finishing their act, a cruel practice that made audiences roar with laughter. Although competition was fierce and spots on the show were difficult, many who even did well on the show did not continue on it to be famous. A few of the exceptions were Frank Sinatra, Beverly Sills, Paul Winchell, and Robert Merrill. Contestants were given $10 and an all-you-can-eat pass to a cafeteria across the street from the studio. Each contestant had to sign a contract stating they would not use Bowes' name to gain them further appearances. If they did happen to get work as a result of being on his show, they were to pay Bowes 15% of their profits. The unlucky ones who didn't make it this far were put on relief and often went on to live on the streets of New York. Some returned home penniless. Characters and personalities were an important component to each show. The Major interviewed contestants and found that the human interest aspect of the show helped raise its popularity. One of the Major's biggest fears was that a gonged contestant would turn nasty. As a result, he always kept a strong bodyguard nearby. Before he would hit the gong, he would signal to the bodyguard, who hustles them up to the microphone and down again. I always single him before letting the bell go, and he always is ready to grab the poor boob before he can say anything vile. As the 1940s grew near, the amateur craze began to wane. Although the show continued until the Major's death in 1946, ratings dropped slightly. The show was again revived in 1948 with Ted Mack, the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, Bowes' friend and former MC as the announcer. This show continued on until the 1950s with some success. So let's close out today's program with a bit of Frank Sinatra, the Hoboken Four.
Falling in love with love is falling for make-believe.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review, and as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me. Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.
Unable to see.